it appears that there is more and more fire and smoke enveloping the very top of the building. And as fire crews are descending on this area, it does not appear that there's any kind of an effort up there yet. Now remember, oh my God.
Oh my God.
That looks like a second plane.
Remember where you were when you heard this? Me? I was in Cambridge, Massachusetts, about to start a fellowship. I was listening to NPR in my new apartment. I'd moved in 2 days earlier, there was very little furniture, no television. And I did a double take when I heard that a plane had hit the World Trade Center. It was reported at first as though it might have been a prop plane, an accident. We'll bring you further details when we have them. And then I listened as the second plane hit, and time seemed to slow down. That thing that happens when something is too overwhelming to process. I listened as the buildings burned and collapsed. I was stunned and stricken, like so many people were. One of the people who died in the towers was someone I knew in college, a friendly acquaintance who I'd chatted with often, danced with at parties. Steve Glick was smart and funny and a good dancer. 20 years later, on 9/11, he was a financial consultant, married with kids, attending a conference in one of the Twin Towers. On 9/11, I wondered what would happen next. I expected this would be treated as an international criminal case. You know, track down the people and groups responsible and bring them to justice. On the evening of 9/11, President Bush went on the air and said this.
America was targeted for attack because we're the brightest beacon for freedom and opportunity in the world. And no one will keep that light from shining.
Which sounded kind of reassuring at the time. But something else was also happening. People were saying, this changes everything. And when President Bush spoke to the nation again 9 days after the attacks, his tone and his message were a little different.
Our war on terror begins with Al-Qaeda, but it does not end there. It will not end until every terrorist group of global reach has been found, stopped, and defeated.
I remember thinking, what? Go after Al-Qaeda, sure, and the Taliban, who had been harboring and supporting Al-Qaeda, but an open-ended war against all terrorists with global reach everywhere in the world, whether they've targeted us or not? A war for which, President Bush said, everyone had to choose sides?
Either you're with us, either you love freedom and with nations which embrace freedom, or you're with the enemy.
When 9/11 happened, I'd been living abroad for 15 years as a foreign correspondent, and I was surprised and dismayed by how quickly Americans embraced a troubling new rhetoric and all that it meant. War on terror, homeland security, enhanced interrogation. It sounded like it was straight out of Orwell. In what came later, the surveillance at home and torture abroad, the endless war on terror, we gave away some of our own freedom and tarnished our own international image. I experienced the change firsthand, going back for another stint as a foreign correspondent based in China and traveling throughout East Asia. In the years after 9/11, China gained stature in East Asia at U.S. expense, because many East Asians felt neglected by the United States and no longer particularly attracted to what America had come to stand for. President Obama's pivot to Asia has been fairly successful at regaining some of that lost ground. Maybe it helped that he'd spent some of his own childhood in Indonesia, that he got that it's not enough to send troops out everywhere and tell everyone to be afraid and to fall in line. People in the region, in many regions, wanted to be respected and included, including Muslims, and they weren't liking what they saw in the post-9/11 world. So, how did we get there? Fear, anger, defensiveness, and propaganda. Now, before you start saying, what? Think about a few definitions of the word propaganda. One is spreading of information in support of a cause, check. Another, a message desired to persuade its intended audience to think and behave in a certain way, check. And a third definition, information that is not impartial, presenting facts selectively, using loaded messages to produce an emotional rather than a rational response to the information presented. That's 3 for 3. Perhaps you're thinking, but wait, propaganda is about distorting the facts, playing dirty, manipulating people. It's what the other guys do, the communists, the dictators. Maybe when you hear the word propaganda, you think of this. The old Soviet Union, or China under Mao, or China now. But the more you see propaganda in different settings, and I've seen it in more than a few countries, you recognize it when you see it at home. So I started wondering, are we Americans more susceptible to propaganda because we think we don't have it here?
This is such a brilliant question. Absolutely. That's why I started teaching propaganda in about 2002, because of Dick Cheney, because of George Bush, because of all the things that we were told about Iraq and Afghanistan.
This is Nina Khrushcheva, great-granddaughter of former Soviet leader Nikita Khrushchev. Nina is now a U.S. citizen. She's been living in the United States for a quarter century and teaches propaganda at the New School in New York. We talked in her office at the New School, which is on a busy New York street, which is why you will periodically be hearing sirens. Nina recalls being struck by the kind of rhetoric the Bush administration was using in the weeks and months after 9/11.
And I'm reading the news, and I'm like, oh my God, you have no idea what's happening to your country. I mean, I felt like as a good Soviet, charitable Soviet, you don't know what's happening to your country. You cannot read between the lines. You have no idea what it is. You're gullible. So let me explain it to you.
In this episode, she does. This is Whose Century Is It? A podcast about ideas, trends, and twists shaping the 21st century. I'm Mary Kay Magstead. We all mark events that matter to us. Societies mark events that matter to them. But in a society, decisions about which events matter and how they're marked are constructed, often by leaders, to shape a certain collective identity, to connect with certain emotions.
Stephen Glick.
John T. Nasso.
William Robert Godshalk.
Michael Gagliarmella.
We remember the dead from the 9/11 attacks, as we should. But we don't read off the names each year of Americans killed in Iraq and Afghanistan, nor of the innocent Iraqi and Afghan civilians killed by Americans since 9/11. By the most conservative estimates, at least 50 times more people than died in 9/11. And Iraq wasn't involved in 9/11. An easy answer might be, they weren't Americans. An unspoken reason might be, they're not the reason we launched the war on terror. We also don't, as a nation, stop to ring bells and read off the names of the dead from domestic mass shootings, or do enough to prevent such deaths. Even though an average of only 9 Americans have been killed each year since 9/11 by Islamic jihadist extremists, while almost 12,000 Americans die each year by being shot to death by other Americans. We become the stories we tell ourselves, that the threats from outside are worse than those from within, that if more Americans have more guns, we'll all be safer, that we're fighting for our freedoms, even if it means having to give up some of our freedoms, that the survival of our nation is in peril, though we survived a civil war that did far worse damage, that torture may be the only way to get the information we need, even though the record doesn't bear that out. Not to mention that engaging in torture slashes into the very values we as a nation say we want to uphold. Nina Khrushcheva has seen her share of messages being shaped to play on emotions and serve an agenda. And even though Americans might think propaganda isn't being used here in the land of the free, she says it very much is.
Something that is interesting that I've discovered here in the United States, where I now live for 25 years, is that, you know, America is very sheepish about admitting that it is engaged in propaganda because we tell the truth or we do whatever we do for the sake of democracy. It's others who are engaged in propaganda. The same thing was with the Soviet Union. It's the Americans who propagate. It's the deceiving West. We are the ones who actually tell the truth.
What do you think Americans should know about propaganda that they generally don't?
I think, first of all, we have to be aware that it exists everywhere. We have to be aware that nobody is spared, that if you think that you're not you know it all and you're cynical and you're sarcastic, you're still as attuned to propaganda as the next guy. I mean, there's a threshold. Sometimes it's higher, sometimes it's lower. 9-1-1 was a horrible attack and created, you know, one of the propaganda examples for me was that, of course, everybody felt that, you know, America is attacked and therefore it had to respond. And instead of sitting down and thinking how you should respond in a reasonable and calculative manner, you kind of you take the gun and, you know, take the gun. And what was that quote from The Godfather? So it seems to me that one should be very aware that it can hit you at any time. And I think that is an important thing to know. But another thing for Americans who don't think that foreign affairs matter, to remember that they matter tremendously. And, you know, those emotional responses for Iraq or Afghanistan, to think in 10 years in advance. And for that, you actually need to know something 10 years in advance, because one of the things that happened with the migrant crisis, refugee crisis in Europe, with ISIS marching in Western Europe and in America to some degree, these are all the consequences of the political decisions, of foreign policy decisions that are made earlier on and often made without the knowledge that should have been involved in it.
In her propaganda class at the New School, Nina challenges her students to be aware of who's trying to shape their perceptions and why, and of what they carry with them subconsciously.
Because it's humbling for my students, especially my American students. I have a lot of foreigners in this class, and so there's very important to see comparisons of how other countries see it and how other students see America and how American students see other countries and what kind of cliches. I mean, in fact, I ask them all the, sort of immediately what kind of, so let's go around the room, who is from where and what kind of a cliche you think, you know, think Russia, what do you think first? If you think China, what comes to mind first? We are not aware that a lot of those perceptions or sound bites of a country are created by various bigotries or political agendas. And I think the awareness is something that we all should strive for. We're not going to get better, but at least we know that we are imperfect.
Do your students ever push back, like, no, that's not propaganda? Or do you
They do. I mean, sometimes when we talk about America is a great nation, like, oh no, America is a great nation. Because one of the things that I also say to them, that as an American, you think you're better than anybody else, even if you don't think you're better than anybody else. You know, some people agree with that, and some people get very upset, and then we talk about it. Sometimes they get it, and sometimes they don't. But hopefully they get better for it, even if they don't agree at the end. At least they have some doubt.
Let's go back a bit to how Nina got her propaganda chops. Much of it is pretty obvious. Growing up in the Soviet Union in the 1960s and 70s, playing as a kid with her great-grandpa, she just thought of him as grandpa, Nikita Khrushchev.
I was growing up at the waning hours, or waning years of the Soviet Union, so I was fully aware that propaganda is a lie, and, you know, nobody likes lies like the Soviet officials standing on the Kremlin mausoleum and greeting us and telling that the Soviet future is the greatest. You know, one of the things that I learned early on is that, for example, Nikita Khrushchev, my grandfather, promised to build communism against America by 1980. And that's exactly the time when I was sort of becoming aware of realities of the Soviet Union and how false they were. And, you know, I'm still waiting for that communism that he promised to build. So in 1980, I knew that there was no communism. When I was growing up, propaganda was a way of life and was a way to basically shrug your shoulders, dismiss it, and have the inner life and the outer life.
Within Nina's family, as in so many families, was an inner life and an outer life. The family didn't talk much about Nikita Khrushchev's son, Leonid, Nina's grandfather, who died on his first day as a fighter pilot in World War II. He was 25 then, already married and father to a little girl, Nina's mom. Leonid had been something of an embarrassment to his parents, a playboy, not a true believer in communism. He drifted for a while, until he discovered a love of flying. He became a good bomber pilot, did that for a while, then pushed to become a fighter pilot. And on his first day out, after 6 sorties, His plane disappeared in battle with Nazi planes, presumably shot down.
He disappeared, went missing in action, which was a crime in Stalin's Russia because no Soviet person should ever go missing because, you know, all Soviet people should be accounted for and you have to die as a hero. But at the time, it was never a problem. It became a problem first during Brezhnev and particularly under Putin when suddenly the fact that Khrushchev's son was missing in action became a commentary on Khrushchev's character. So Khrushchev's son was missing in action. But actually, he wasn't missing in action. He actually went and became traitor to the Nazis. And it was a very interesting propaganda trick. Not even that interesting, but basic, but clever, because it's known that Stalin's son, one of Stalin's sons, was captured by the Nazis and died a hero in a concentration camp. He was shot when he was trying to escape. So we will make Khrushchev, who denounced Stalin, which was a really bad thing for the greatness of the Soviet Union, because the following leader should not denounce the previous leader, especially a great leader who won the World War, Great Patriotic War, it's called in Russia. So we're going to make his son a traitor and then say, well, that boy was a traitor. He was missing in action. He went to the Nazis. Well, of course, there's no proof, but who cares? And therefore, his father, who denounced Stalin, of course, was a horrible leader, because what kind of a father could be if even his son is a traitor? And that really has been a pressing story in Russia in the last 10 years for my family, because you have to defend the name. And it's very difficult because nobody's looking for proof, but everybody is looking for emotion. And then what becomes a big propaganda story, because World War II is an emotional story. And
you went looking for proof. You spent like 10 years looking for proof to see what actually happened.
Well, yeah, I spent 10 years as a...
On and off.
Yes, on and off, right. But I did go looking for proof that it's not the case. But I didn't, not because I believed that he was a traitor, but I wanted to say that he was not. I found that he was not, that Khrushchev's son was not a traitor. I found that there is no way I can convince those who don't want to be convinced, because once again, it's not about the facts, it's about emotions. And since we like Stalin, it was a big, strong country, and then Khrushchev denounced Stalin, so we don't want to like Khrushchev, so we'll make his son a traitor, and that's it.
Nina's quest to find out what really happened to her grandfather is recounted in her book, The Lost Khrushchev. In it, she tells how eventually she found a memorial from the late 1940s with Leonid Khrushchev's name on it, honoring him for his service. In other words, Stalin wasn't calling him a traitor. That came later, after Nikita Khrushchev was ousted from power. That was propaganda.
So the rumors started coming out of it. Khrushchev really stands in the middle of all of it. I don't think it's myself aggrandizing or the family aggrandizing, is that he does stand in between Stalin and Putin, which is a very important kind of linchpin of the whole development, because Stalin is the leader of Russia of the 20th century, won the World War II. Russia was an industrial country. Everybody was afraid of it. Khrushchev denounced him for the sake of freedoms. Mikhail Gorbachev, the great leader during Perestroika and Glasnost, the one who freed the Soviet Union from its own chains, always admitted that he was Khrushchev's disciple and Khrushchev was his mentor in his actions. And then Putin comes in and says, in not so many words, that Stalin is my mentor and my leader, but certainly tries to create Russia that Stalin would have approved of. So gather territories, suppress the enemies, really try to bring Stalin back to the public view. And for example, one of the metro stations, subway stations in Moscow, suddenly about 10 years ago got Stalin's name, which was shocking because Khrushchev was persona non grata when he was ousted in 1964 for 20 years. But Stalin was never a public name either. So Brezhnev could not bring Stalin as a public name. Suddenly under Putin, Stalin becomes a public name. So, you know, the last example, Crimea. Crimea that Putin so vigorously took away from Ukraine in 2014, something that Khrushchev gave to Ukraine in 1953, 54, is a administrative measure, but an important measure because he was trying, after Stalin's death in 53, Khrushchev tried to decentralize the Soviet Union. So even in that, you know, kind of giving away territories, bringing back territories, Khrushchev stand in the middle of Putin's politics.
Yeah. So it's also about manipulating emotions, right? You were saying it's, you know, 4 + 4 = 5. Don't think about it, just believe it.
It is manipulating. I mean, there's various methodological formulas that achieve propaganda success. And, you know, there's a bandwagon. So you create a public perception and then you don't need to prove anything anymore. So the public perception takes over, or you can have propaganda by omission. You can use kind of a segue that you have a few true statements and then a segue into an untrue statement. So you have a little bit of a truth and then the untrue part. And it happens everywhere. It happens all the time. I mean, with Putin and Khrushchev, Putin was not anti-Khrushchev when he came in. In fact, Putin was known for his pronouncements of saying, well, I don't see how NATO is a threat to Russia. I mean, it was a big argument that he made. Or early on in his presidency, he was saying that, you know, Russia is of course, is the member of the West, and there's no such thing. I mean, it is a European country. And so, but you see that how the tide is changing, because things either doesn't work with the West or it doesn't work with the economy in it, within the country and whatnot. So propaganda is also very fluid this way. And so Putin created his own persona. At the beginning, the persona was a very kind of James Bond of contemporary Russia. He was bare-chested and saving tigers and saving dolphins and doing all these wonderful things. And then that persona required a strong hand. And so that's how Stalin came in.
Well, and following on from your earlier observation that in some ways there's nothing new under the sun when it comes to propaganda, that there are certain tropes that keep coming up in different societies, totalitarian, authoritarian, democratic, and I'm putting that in quotations in the air because, you know, even the most democratic society is only democratic to a point and has its flaws. And one thing that popped out for me in your book, The Last Khrushchev, was when you talked about how there's this talk about sort of the holy mission of Russia, the word holy, that there's just something, you know, sort of spiritual and uplifting and important about this. And I, because during the 2008 Olympics in Beijing, there was this refrain of the Olympic torch, it's being a holy journey, and that this must be protected against anyone who seeks to humiliate or get in the way, humiliate China or get in the way of this mission. And of course, going back over the centuries, there were the Crusades. There are ways in which, you know, this sort of God is on our side trope is invoked by many countries, including the United States, when it's at war or when it faces an adversary.
But absolutely. I mean, first of all, Russia and America both are messianic societies. If we put it in more mundane terms, there's a frontier, because both are frontier countries. These are frontier imitation cultures, because both imitate Europe, or at least at the beginning, the kind of a modern conception of it, they were imitating Europe. So as frontier imitation cultures, they push its own version of savior of human race. So Russia does it through the spiritual mission, which is always the heart, and we are, you know, spiritual to the point of no return, and we have a soul and nobody like us. And America does it through, you know, nobody is as great democracy as we are, and we are promoting the comfort of that, which of course is a much more appealing concept, frankly. I mean, I do love my soul, but, you know, I don't want to die for it, at least not in the 21st century, for sure. Absolutely. But I think all countries, I mean, you know, that's why in some ways when every country that says I'm special, yes, but every country is special. And those who say that we are the most special ones, of course, are deluding themselves. I mean, I think size matters. I think international influence matters, which often, by the way, is a size relevant. As much as we want to say we moved away from it, we have not. I think probably Great Britain is one of the few countries that is smaller in size and bigger in influence to some degree, but let's also be very honest, it used to be big and kind of keeps feeding off that. So all countries think that they're special. And, you know, I'm sure China, as you mentioned, it's the Middle Kingdom. As the Middle Kingdom, it has all the special rights and it's the center of the universe. And with Olympics or any sports event, you know, in propaganda terms, it is the metaphor for war. If you don't want to fight a war, you fight the Olympics. And the Cold War, all this who is better than whom, just precisely because we're not fighting the war, but we're fighting it on a sports field rather than a battlefield. And I think it still holds, probably more than anything. I mean, look at the Sochi Olympics that Russians did in 2014. My God, that was fought like World War II battle.
There's much to learn from the Russian experience about propaganda, but there's also something to learn from how the post-9/11 world was shaped. Nina Khrushcheva sees former Vice President Dick Cheney as the main architect of that world, and he kind of fascinates her.
I mean, I love Dick Cheney. I have to, and I'm not really being facetious. I do love him. He's a work of art. He's actually not a propagandist. He has people for that. The reason I love him, he's a born dictator. It's very hard to find. I mean, he's the best in his trade. He's like exotic flower. And when I always say in those instances that God has a sense of humor, is that so in the 20th century, the end of the 20th century, all dictatorships have been denounced. Democracy is firmly marching around the world. China is turning, seems to be on the road to democracy. Russia, all of those countries. Fidel Castro is outliving his old age. And suddenly in arguably the most democratic country in the world, sort of the beacon of democracy, as they call the United States, we encounter Dick Cheney as vice president. I mean, you know, and it was really, from my point of view, was Dick Cheney's administration. It was not George Bush's administration. And I'm proud to say I saw it the first. I thought I really recognized him as a dictator before other people did, just because I was so trained in dictatorial propaganda recognition. And he was just announced as a vice presidential nominee, which, by the way, we know he obtained by very undemocratic means. That is, he was never vetted by anybody. In fact, he was in charge of picking the vice president. He vetted all these people, said, I think I'm the best. And that's how he became a vice presidential nominee, which in itself is a beautiful thing because America is all about institutions of democracy, of process. And here he was coming in just like that. And so he was interviewed by the whole press corps in Washington, D.C. And he was asked about Halliburton because he was the chairman of the board of Halliburton at the time, or around that time. And so how he's going to deal with the very powerful lobby, the military-industrial complex, and all these other things. And it was even before his smirk, I think. He still had a little bit of a smirk, but not as much. He looked around, and very quietly he said, "I resigned from Halliburton. There is no conflict of interest, and there will be no more questions." And I just shivered because I heard this thing. I grew up with those dictators. I knew them by heart. They were standing on the mausoleum. They would just in a quiet voice, you say what it is, and nobody dares to ask any further questions. So I thought, oh, in a democracy, what do? We ask a follow-up question. Do the Halliburton people never see you in the office? Is there going to be a restraining order? How are you going to protect your office from this kind of influences? And suddenly the whole Washington, D.C. press corps said, okay. And the next question was about foreign policy. And it's like, that's my man. I know him by heart. And so then he becomes the vice president, and I kind of watch him do the war on terror and enhance the intimidation techniques. And he says what he says, and he says that we're going to protect the country because the country is at risk and those who are not with us are against us and whatnot. And it's like, oh my God, I've heard it all before. I know these people. I'm not comparing them to the despots of the Soviet Union. But once again, there's only that many things you can invent and say. But he was the one who created that whole political climate. He was the one who went back. I don't know if people remember what the continuity of government was. Those who watched Dr. Strangelove in 64, they were those underground bunkers that when everything collapses, the few very important government people stay on and create the new humanity. So he was involved in this program, which was a real program in the United States since the Nixon years. So he was really all these cliches and formulas that propaganda of the Cold War, or sort of humorous propaganda of the Cold War, represented, things that we learned to mock, like in Dr. Strangelove. He is Dr. Strangelove.
And Dick Cheney has remained pretty consistent in his message. Here he is in June 2014, being challenged by anchor Megyn Kelly on Fox News.
But time and time again, history has proven that you got it wrong as well in Iraq, sir. You said there was no doubt Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. You said we would be greeted as liberators. You said the Iraq insurgency was in the last throes back in 2005. And you said that after our intervention, extremists would have to, quote, rethink their strategy of jihad. Now, with almost $1 trillion spent there, with 4,500 American lives lost there, what do you say to those who say you were so wrong about so much at the expense of so many?
No, I just fundamentally disagree, Megyn. You've got to go back and look at the track record. We inherited a situation where there was no doubt in anybody's mind about the extent of Saddam's involvement in weapons of mass destruction.
And here he is in December the same year, talking to Chuck Todd on NBC's Meet the Press about the Senate's torture report, which said that a review of 6 million CIA documents showed no evidence that torture had yielded life-saving, game-changing information.
Does it plant any seed of doubt in you, though?
No.
No seed of doubt at all? All of
absolutely
this, all of this information in here, no seed of doubt that whether this worked or not?
It worked. It absolutely did work.
And then there was this, a bit later, in the same interview.
I'm more concerned with bad guys who got out and released than I am with a few in fact, were innocent.
25% of the detainees, though, 25% turned out to be innocent. They were
innocent. Where are you going to draw the line, Chuck? How are you going to know?
Is that you're okay with that margin for error?
I have no problem as long as we achieve our objective. And our objective is to get the guys who did 9/11, and it is to avoid another attack against the United States.
And he's like a black orchid. He's an absolute oxymoron of democracy, and yet he arguably was the most important man. He turned vice presidential job, which is an irrelevant job to a degree, one of the most important jobs in the world, if not the most important job in the world. That's amazing.
Nina spends a lot of time thinking about Dick Cheney, and not only because a rubber bust of him sits in her office, along with propaganda posters and a collection of wine bottles, each bearing the face of a dictator. She playfully calls them Dick-taters, D-I-C-K, for obvious reasons. The wine bottles were from an exhibition she put together at Parsons called Romancing Through Power. At the exhibition, people were invited to vote for who they thought was the biggest dick.
And Dick is not necessarily a dictator in a traditional sense, but it's an alpha male personality that, given a chance, could be a dictator. So Dick Cheney is one of those. We have Vladimir Putin. We have Silvio Berlusconi. We didn't put any royalty in it because tsars or monarchs are by definition dicks, just because that's how they structured. So it was more of a modern formula, kind of democratic formula. So there were all sorts of people, from Saddam Hussein to Nicolae Ceausescu in Romania, to Vladimir Putin, to Mao Zedong. The first prize was Turkish Recep Erdogan. The second prize were the three kings of North Korea. The fourth prize was Putin and Stalin. And the fifth was Mao Zedong, because you have to go with your classics. And so we made our own Dick Moore. So in Mount Rushmore, we just put their faces in at Dick Moore. And so there's a lot of other things. We served Dick wine, and you know, it was a lot of fun. But we really try to say something important, is that what makes a dick, and so what is a dictatorship in a democracy, dictatorship in a democracy, and what does it mean to have a dictatorial power? What common trends they have? What unites them? What separates them? And I thought it was very timely because, you know, the world in the last year and a half, exactly since our exhibit, the world has been talking about this kind of strongman leaders in Turkey and Viktor Orban in Hungary. And now Poland is suddenly turning slightly less democratic. And, you know, we have Narendra Modi in India and the El Sisi in Egypt and whatnot. So in some ways, I felt like we did something fun, but also rather relevant to understanding of the world.
Looking forward, not even just a decade, but more than that, in the 21st century, are you seeing any sorts of interesting trends or changes in propaganda that you're seeing both in the U.S. and in Russia, and actually beyond, that's different from before? That, you know, perhaps the audience has become slightly more sophisticated, or at least familiar with certain types of propaganda, so that it's evolved?
I think it's certainly evolved, but I would say, from my point of view, it's less sophisticated than before, because before it was less fluid. I mean, if you talk about dictatorial propaganda, it's very ossified. I mean, there's only certain things that you can imagine. As I said, you know, it's pornography, so you can figure it out very quickly. So in some ways, you can become prepared. But I think because of social media, it becomes very fluid and amorphous. So it's very difficult now to pinpoint what it is and what it is not. And I think that makes it more complicated and makes us think, oh, but we know it all. It really not it is, because there's no more golden statue and there is no more hand charging on and showing you the bright future. And the statue is not 10 feet tall. And so that means that there's no propaganda. Of course, it doesn't mean that. It comes in all shapes and sizes. It comes in Donald Trump's tweets that are being retweeted. It comes in various forms of bigotry that then go into protests during Donald Trump's rallies, or not even Donald Trump's rallies, or recently stories started emerging of the KKK's getting back its influence, which is terrifying, because this is something that should be outlawed. I mean, I know it sounds very undemocratic for Americans, but it really should be outlawed, because it is incitement of hatred like there is no tomorrow. And in every other country, it should be, and America always lectures other countries on outlawing this kind of organizations. But in America, of course, we're a free society, and therefore we should allow those people to exist. So suddenly they get an advocate, they get a champion. But because it's diffused and amorphous and really is not coming out of the White House, at least not yet, and it doesn't, there's no special decision on the part of the party, one party or another, that seems like it's not propaganda, but it doesn't make it so.
So your students are in the generation that's going to live through much of this century. So if you had like one piece of advice to give them on their way out the door after your class, is it just be aware?
Be curious.
Be curious and be vigilant, yeah?
Yes, be curious, but be interested. I mean, sort of when I say Marc Chagall, don't dismiss it as some Russian painter. When I say Ai Weiwei, don't think that his only value is that he's a dissident. When I say, I don't know, Adam Smith, don't think of him as something that is quoted in somebody's paper. Actually go take a book and read it. And that's how they should understand other cultures. So I want them to be curious.
So this is a really interesting answer, because what I'm hearing you say, I think, is that part of how you defend yourself from being manipulated by propaganda you don't want to be manipulated by is you're more open-minded from the beginning, that you listen to different ways of thinking, different ways of living, different forms of expression, and you recognize that your own perspective is not the only way.
Absolutely. Because I think that for us, it's very important. I mean, I'm a Democrat. I mean, I'm basically, you know, I'm as left as they come. I'm not a communist like Bernie Sanders, socialist, sorry. But I am liberal. I'm teaching the most liberal, probably one of the most liberal universities in America. But one of the things that a requirement for my class, for my propaganda class, is that they cannot be ideological. Because ideology really creates all this. Because you think, if Barack Obama is right and Dick Cheney is wrong, then you know all the answers. And when I say I love Dick Cheney, people just roll their eyes like, oh, how could you love that horrible man? But you don't have to love that horrible man. I admire people for what they are. I mean, he's the best in his trade. And so I'm curious to learn about him. So yes, I mean, there is many points of view, and we're in humanities. I mean, I'm not a scientist, so political science doesn't exist, despite the fact that we were told that it does. is that we're in humanities, and there are as many points of view as possible. And the only way you can deal with it is that if you argue your point of view to me convincingly, I'm with you. I don't have to agree with you, but it's the argument. It's that persuasion that is not propaganda that I really value the most.
Nina Khrushcheva, thanks for joining me on Whose Century Is It?
Thank you.
So you can't escape propaganda, but be vigilant. Be aware of who's trying to play on your emotions and why. Ads, movies, your government. And being curious enough to learn and understand other perspectives is kind of an inoculation against propaganda. And as a bonus, it makes you a better world citizen. It makes the United States what many of us as citizens want it to be, a nation that's tolerant and open, that others admire and want to emulate. That doesn't mean giving up on defense or giving terrorists a pass, but an endless war on terror was not a smart or effective way to achieve our goals or maintain our status. It changed us in ways that ultimately worked against our very desire to continue as a world leader and a positive example in this century. There's a reason why President Obama has chosen from the beginning not to use the term war on terror. And if you ask me, it was a good reason. It turned a page. There's a great cover story by Stephen Brill in the September edition of The Atlantic, based on a year-long investigation. It's called Are We Any Safer? And it looks at what we have now after spending $1 trillion to protect the homeland and create a new vast security state. I recommend it. And I'd also like to recommend two powerful podcast episodes from my colleague Rupa Shenoy, creator and host of the PRI podcast Otherhood. Both were done in my home state, Minnesota, looking at the Somali community in Minneapolis, from which several young men and boys have tried to join ISIS or the extremist group Al-Shabaab in Somalia. Rupa looks at the cost of racism, fear, and exclusion toward Black Muslim immigrants in a largely white community, and she connects it with racism and fear toward African Americans in the same community, where Philando Castile was shot and killed by a policeman in July while reaching for his wallet. You can find Otherhood at pri.org/programs/otherhood or on your favorite podcast app. And you can find more on propaganda and other themes in this episode on this podcast webpage, pri.org/century. You can also find us on iTunes and other podcast apps. Subscribe if you haven't yet. We're also on SoundCloud and Stitcher. Whose Century Is It? Is a co-production between me and PRI's The World in cooperation with the BBC World Service and WGBH. It's funded by a grant from the Henry Luce Foundation. Thanks for listening. Join us next time.